Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, Griefsters. I hope you're having an okay week wherever you're listening. It's heading into the depths of winter where I am. It's getting darker and colder and the world, as ever, is in flux. So I hope where you are today has been a day full of tea and cake and stability in whatever way that's possible. I know I say it every week, but just a reminder, I have a book coming out. It's called You Are Not Alone. You can pre-order it now. It is available to buy from January the 17th. It's everything I've learned from the podcast over the past 6 years, with quotes from people who've been on and, essays from me about what happened to me and all the things I've learned. And I said, you can pre-order it now, which is an incredibly helpful way to support authors. It all goes towards the first week of sales if you do a pre-order, so it'd be massively, massively appreciated if you do that. Thank you so much if you've done so already, and thank you for your wonderful comments about this series so far. As ever, it's always been a joy to talk to these incredible people who've been sharing their stories with us. This week I'm talking to the brilliant musician Tom Rosenthal. Tom has released 6 albums to date. You may have come across Tom when one of his songs, Dinosaurs in Love, went viral in 2020. It was composed by his daughter, Fen. I remember it particularly because it was a very joyful thing that we were all sharing at a time when there wasn't much joy happening in 2020. His latest album is called Dennis Was a Bird, and he wrote it in 2021 about his father's death. And that's who Tom is talking to me about this week, his dad. So, Tom, who are we remembering today?
Who are we remembering? Right, remembering my father.
Your dad.
His name was Dennis Pym.
Dennis Pym?
Yes, didn't share... Oh, an immediate twist.
Immediate twist.
ImmediateTwist.com.
Dennis Pym is just lovely. It's very 1950s,
let's get straight into
it.
Yeah, he I don't share a surname with him, although he is in my middle names, my middle names being Paul Pym.
Oh.
Now, interestingly enough, Paul Pym is the name of his wife.
Oh, my God.
But I know. Isn't that interesting? That must be the first time that middle name is the name of the wife. But his wife has an E on it, and she's French, but people call her Paul.
Okay.
Because, I don't know, that kind of works somehow. but yes, immediate twist. My father had 3 children before he had me.
Oh, okay.
I was a bastardo, a classic bastard. So I was a product of an affair that he had with my mother when he was when he was 50, because I was born when he was 50. So he had 3 children first, and then he had me. So I think because he had already had the 3 children, my mother had me quite late. She was 38. So I think she might have gone, well, look, I might just be having the one kid here. She was correct. And I don't actually know the conversation they would have had, but I think that she just went, look, well, you know, I think he should be a Rosenthal. And so hence why we don't share a name, which is interesting. So that's interesting number one.
Interesting twist number one. Did you, like, when growing up, did you have a lot of contact with him, or was it more an unusual, obviously it's not a traditional relationship.
Kind of thing. It was not traditional at all. He would visit, I would say, every couple of months, it felt like, or so to me, from this distance we are now. I might have been remembering that slightly wrong, but sometimes also I would go to where he lived, which was in Suffolk, on a kind of small holding, kind of organic-y farm type place, just a small farm set up, basically, with vegetable garden and some animals, but not lots of animals, not like on industrial scale. So he was like a farmer amongst lots of other things. So yeah, so sometimes I would go there, but I would so it'd always be intermittent and like sporadic and kind of not like heavy quantity.
Was he still with his wife at this point, just to...
Yes. He had a lot of affairs, actually.
Right. Okay.
In which I don't know that. To be honest, I don't know that much about other affairs. And I actually don't know if they were necessarily affairs, but more dalliances.
Right,
what would you call them? Like moments. and that was, you know, that was pretty prevalent throughout most of his, like, sexual life, I suppose. I think at some point he, like, definitely, like, probably wouldn't have had it in him to do much more. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yes, so where am I going to? He essentially chose to return to his wife after being with my mother. However, another twist.
Okay.
In this podcast of many twists. Another twist is that he and my mother and my, let's call her my stepmother, Paul, became friends.
Wow.
Remained friends. And found a way to kind of make it work.
Wow.
I don't, you know, which is really an amazing thing. I think they all obviously had a part to play, but I think the lead character was Paul, because she, when it came down to it, chose to embrace what had happened rather than not. Maybe it's a classical French thing, maybe kind of let's just do it, you know, kind of let's just make the best of it.
For you as a child to not be, as you said, like rejected, cut out, removed,
felt
like you're the bastard, but for someone to be like, yep, you're another child, welcome.
Yeah
that's amazing.
So basically, you know, Paul is, I would say, in doing that, made probably the biggest difference to my life of anyone that could make a difference. I mean, so it's huge. So for me, like, I couldn't love someone more than I, you know, love her, if you know what I mean, for that.
It's such a generous thing to do, isn't it, that she didn't have to. And that I guess what you mean is, like, yeah, nobody would have judged her if it would have been like,
oh, completely,
I don't want him around. We'd have been like, fair play, like, that's you know, the
out
child
of lives,
an affair.
Whatever.
Yeah
completely.
That's very painful for her. So for her to be that magnanimous is incredible testament to her, definitely, and her love.
Exactly. So she got everyone. She was the one that kind of went to all the kids, look, let's do it. You know, they were really, obviously, it must be really perturbed. Suddenly, they were like, I don't know, 18, 20 and 22 or kind of ages.
Yeah.
Suddenly, like, oh, hang on, there's another little kid popping up.
Yeah.
He's a half sibling. So really, what she did was just an amazing thing. And she continues to be amazing and a wonderful woman to this very day.
Oh,
and she's alive and well.
So
that was kind of that was the big twist, really. But I always still grew up, I was always like a little bit like that odd child at the back. You know, like, no, some people who were around the farm couldn't quite place me, you know, if you were visiting from elsewhere, like, he looks like a member of family, but he's a bit young to be.
Yeah.
Is he like a grandchild? Like, no one could, you know, he's kind of in between generations. Which always felt like a bit odd. And I found myself, I was at one of those ones, you got two choices when that kind of thing happens. Either you hide away and go, oh God, I hope they don't bring it up, or kind of, you know, whatever. And then I thought, actually, in the end, it's better to take someone to the side and go, look, here's the situation. Bosh, 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 bosh. You're probably thinking about it. Like, I'll just tell you, and then we can just get on with it. So I chose that. And that's probably helped me I don't know, be a little bit more direct in my life, just generally, just in terms of communication, and not just leave things just up in the air and just let people know what's going on. Because sometimes it's awkward. Some people find things awkward, understandably, and sometimes you've got to step in there. So it wasn't without its awkward stuff, but the core... The core was love. So just incredibly lucky, because it could have been just disastrous. And I just probably, I could have been an awful person. Maybe I am an awful person, but I could have been really bad.
No, but I was just thinking that you said those two options, and that's really interesting to me, because the two options of a child or, you know, young person, like, is to either be ashamed of it, as you said, to hide away, or to not be. But because the parents weren't ashamed, there was no shame given down to you. So you could go, oh, just so you know, that's my dad. That's not my mum. This is what's happening. Da-da-da-da. Whereas if it had been hidden away and no one talked about it, or you, then you would have picked up on, oh, this is something wrong. There's something, I shouldn't be here.
Oh, exactly.
And so because she, as you said, she led with that, then you didn't, you were able to go, oh, hey, guess what? Unusual situation. Let me tell you about it. So that's amazing, isn't it? That you forget that how quickly kids can pick up on things.
Kids pick up pigs. Kids. Freudian sit there. The bloody pigs. The kids really do pick up on everything.
Yeah, they know. They know. Why is that person here? They're not like you said. Yeah. How is that their brother when their brother's so old? And that's not what brothers look like in, you know, in terms of what is expected, not what is normal. So when did Dennis die? What happened?
Yes, he died in 2019. May 2019. What's that? That's 3 years?
3 years ago, yeah.
Just over 3 years ago.
Pre-pandemic.
Pre-pandemic. He missed that one. Yeah. He missed all that fun. But it was a long time. It was it was one of those deaths. There was a long time coming, in a sense. He had Parkinson's from, I don't know, he died at 80, he was 83 when he died. Parkinson's from like early 70, for 10 years before or so, which was like, I actually think considerably worse than dying is actually, watching someone decline. Mm. I mean, which will happen to so many. I mean, that's such a common experience, really. But I would take... obviously it's weird to say, but like, I would take him being struck by lightning at 75 over degenerative disease killing him at 83, if I could choose such a thing. And I think, that was, it's really tough watching someone just, and especially, I mean, of course, this is always going to happen. He was like very, very fit. He was a farmer, he honestly did look, everyone says this, of course, but, when he was 70, he looked 50. Do you know, he's that kind of vibe. Yeah. He was incredibly healthy. They just ate their own vegetables the whole time. He would sprint about everywhere. He was an old dad to me, obviously, having it at 50, but he never felt like an old dad because he was just fit and, with it, etc. So, obviously, to see him go from that to go right down. And, of course, he's living a very physical life. If you live on a farm, everything is physical. You get up, you feed the sheep, you do the chickens, you lift a fence, you lift a bale of hay, you move this, you go up and down all day. It's the terrain is not necessarily like a beautiful flat thing. It's, up, it's kind of, there are hills, it's kind of, and that was his life. So kind of to then have to live that life, seeing all the things that kind of need to be doing, and you can no longer do, was kind of obviously just more painful than, say, if he was just some kind of armchair guy who watched TV all day,
What happened to the farm then when he was deteriorating? Did someone have to come and take over?
Luckily, there are, two of his children, my siblings, live very close to the farm.
Right, okay.
One works on it every day as a carpenter, my brother Dill, who actually is currently beneath me as we speak.
Okay.
In the with my, because he's staying. So he's about... So the farm was, and it was an easy transition.
Well, yeah, but like you said, he's transition. Still having to watch. And I mean, we talk about that a lot on the show, of like sudden, the phone call in the night, the heart attack versus, like you said, I guess normally we talk about terminal illness, which is equally, but yeah, there's something, I guess there's a different category, isn't it, with degenerative. It's like you said, it's a longer, slower process. And obviously, there's no winning. everybody at the end is the thing where someone you love is dead. But yeah, I think, like you said, to My dad was like that, not a farmer at all, but very fit, very, very, very fit. And training for an Ironman and then got cancer. And it's such a... I think it gives a lot more shock in a way, because your brain is like, what? They used to do that. They used to do that. And I guess you had it on a much slower... Like, you're watching a film for 10 years, which I watched for 2 months. Like, it's a much more extended film, is all I can think to say.
So
when did he... What happened just before he died then? Had he got to the point where he was...
Yeah. So there's also... Sick? I mean, it's interesting what you say, because I think there's also, like, the people who... the beauty of the degenerative, I mean, so I'm being sarcastic, obviously, but you also get the call. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's not like, you know, just an instant, a gradual decline from, you know, it's not like a phone battery. It's like suddenly it's like, and it's like now we're in that zone. And actually, the thing about death, a bit like birth, actually, well, basically it's the same, you know, it's so similar in many ways, but until it actually happens, you can't really conceive of it. And even if you think you can conceive of it, you really can't.
And even like... And you can swear blind.
Exactly.
And like, no, I've read a book on it.
Exactly. Oh, no. I've heard, you know, 170 grief casts. Like, unless you're there doing it, you just don't know until you're there. So actually, there was a kind of like, I think Paul needed some rest and she tried to put him completely wisely in a kind of home type place, which was local. And then from then on, I think he basically chose to die. I think that was when he was like,
wow.
I think he made the decision somehow. And there are a few other pointers towards that. By the end, obviously, the terrible thing about Parkinson's, it could be connected to Alzheimer's. And so, you know, you can just basically really lose it. I mean, everything's starting to go, basically. So he lost a lot of weight and then went into hospital in Ipswich. I now have bad Ipswich connotations. and I think he was there for about 5 or 6 weeks. And that was a really interesting time. And we were kind of, it was pretty clear that he wasn't really getting out of there, you know, and then it'd be a question of kind of timing. And then we went there as a family. Luckily, this is the beauty of having a big family. You get to, you know, we could swap in and out. You know, there was his children, but also his children's partners who were like part of the family. And, you know, I would go on a Monday, someone else would go on a Tuesday, you know. So he was like never alone, but we were mixing it up. And so we could also just like live our lives at the same time as well. And so, and that was just an old experience. It's like waiting for him to die. But also then, of course, the actual experience of it was... also so different from just the waiting bit. But that's such a profound time, that those kind of those weeks. He didn't really know what was going on, would respond to some things. There were like tiny moments of lucidity, tiny. And I still have one, which is the one that's going to stay with me, I think, which is, so he was the kind of dad who maybe was from an era where really handily we're kind of losing people, sorry, we're losing this particular trait of people who were born in this era, but he never told me that he loved me. He couldn't basically he couldn't do it. It was like it was like some kind of mental block. I think almost certainly I could 100% guarantee that his parents wouldn't have said it to him, but that's not, but he knew that was, he tried to say it in a million different ways, and I knew he did. It wasn't an issue. It wasn't like 100%.
You didn't feel unloved, but you just couldn't
say
it.
And there were some times I remember him kind of sitting next to me and kind of trying to say it, but not quite managing to say it, or just trying to say it a different way. And I probably should have just interrupted and say, well, Dad, do you want to say, but you know, it's hard to kind of say that obviously in the moment. Now, but in hospital, I was with him on one of these Mondays, and it felt pretty close to the end thing times. And remember, so, you know, if I'm there for like 7 or 8 hours, I feel like, God, moments of lucidity would have just been in, I don't know, say minutes of that.
Yeah.
You know, tiny little minutes. The rest of it kind of just not quite being there. And that just got, those minutes just got fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer, obviously, as we went on. But one particular time, I was just sitting there. And obviously, you know, maybe he was just coming up from sleeping or whatever. And then he obviously woke up, looked at me and just said, I love you, Tom. You know, like, and he never said it. So I feel like...
Oh, my God, you're joking.
I feel like he had to just get it out. You know, so these things that like were kind of, you know, that obviously this build up, he knew that actually this is my moment. I think he knew he was done, you know, but like he basically seized the time. And then maybe like 20 seconds later, I don't know whatever happened. I definitely said I loved him. Then back into nothing. And I kind of like, there's part of me, you know, I'm kind of not, I'm definitely, you know, I'm the opposite. I think I'm the opposite of a fantasist, you know, like I don't believe in anything. Yeah. You know, I don't believe in ghosts or God or, you know, whatever, dreams, whatever. But you know, I think, well, maybe there's a tiny chance I just like somehow just dreamt it somehow. But I'm 99.9% sure he did say it. But yeah, so that was a great moment. And that was
huge, Tom. That's not what I thought you were going to say at all. I thought you were going to be like, you know, he squeezed my hand and I felt like he meant it, you know, but to literally be like, this is the one thing I've never said to you.
Yeah.
I love you.
And he got it
and
out.
To get your name as well. So, yeah. You know, like, he's not like, not with it. Like, he knows who he's talking to.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And that was it. And basically, I got so little out of it. The only other thing I got out of him is I offered him some chocolate. I said, Dad, you want some chocolate? And he said, look, I'm always going to want chocolate. Like that is like, you know, just as like,
I'm
bother,
with him on that.
Don't bother
asking
what a stupid question.
Yeah, like, well, don't.
Just
like, I mean,
why are you asking? Just hand me
no
the chocolate.
Consequence
I'm
to this
dying
chocolate.
Now. So yeah. Just like, what's going to be, you know, what's going to make any difference?
Put the IV drip in of hot chocolate, mate. Get it in. I would say exactly the same thing on my deathbed. But just make sure there's always some chocolate in my mouth, guys.
Yeah.
I just want constant. Oh my God, that's amazing.
And then the dying itself was a whole other thing.
Were you there?
Oh, I was. And I'll tell you something to anyone listening now. If you can be there, move heaven and earth to be there, I would say. As in, like, I think there's no more important, like, I don't, what's the word? Well, there's always no more important moment. But actually, so not just about that. It's about the future. I think it's about, one, if you witness it, you realise it's not as bad as you would think.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I think, you know that saying, which I think roughly speaks to most of existence, where things are, you know, not as good as you had hoped or not as bad as you expected. You know?
Yeah.
On the whole, most things fall into that category, you know?
Yeah.
And very much you think, oh my God, a death. Like, how am I going to, God, watching someone die? Like, and we're obviously protected from all these things all the time, right? We never see anyone die. Like, I suppose, kind of understandably, but also we don't really see animals die. We're so disconnected from the actual vision of it.
Yeah, and we have such medicalized way compared to what your dad's parents would have grown up with people dying at home. You know, it's not that long ago, but yes, it's very removed from us these days.
So I didn't know much really about it until I saw it, and it was pure fluke. Again, we were on a kind of rotor system. We didn't exactly know when he was going to die, and it all happened quite quickly. I was just so lucky to be there, along with like a funny arrangement of like family characters. Who I say family characters, you know, there's a big family, you know, kids and grandkids and whatever, just a kind of a mix. And to be there was just an incredible honor, and to watch it was just amazing. And I don't know, it just helped so much with just being like, that was that, you know, and now it's just on we go with whatever this world is. But it's like, it's the perfect bridge to the new world without this person. And I think, and I feel so bad for people who don't get to do that. But what I'm saying is, if you couldn't choose, if you're like, oh, it's a flight, or oh God, you know, oh, it's going to cost, you know, £100 more. Maybe I'll just go for the, you know, I'll go for the funeral, or I'll turn up afterwards or whatever. It's not the same. Like, if you can just, if you can watch that and you can see, you know, you can see a spirit leave someone, you know, you can see the process. And if you can see that, it just, oh, I don't know, it just goes into you and you understand it and you get it. And oddly, it becomes like, I don't know, in seeing what is the biggest deal of all the deals, oddly, it becomes less of a big deal. Do you know what I mean? You've seen it, you've understood it, and you've no longer have to kind of, you know, wear the anxiety of not seeing it or what that meant to not have been there, or you know, in someone's final moments. And often someone's final moments are not very film-like. You know, it's not like, you know, they're in their own world. They're focusing on dying. They're like off the whole, on the whole, just trying to die. They're going to another, they're just in another place. It isn't like, oh, quick, let me say something really meaningful to each member of the family. You know,
yeah,
like,
I know. We've said that a lot on the show. Like the idea of Hollywood endings, just it doesn't exist, yeah. The Hollywood death. And I think, yeah, it's... because obviously some people can't, and you said some people get the phone call and they don't get that experience. But and I know some people feel, yeah, it's such an individual process. It's such an individual process of what you can handle and what you want to. But yeah, I was there when my dad died, and I certainly appreciated it, even though it was traumatic, definitely traumatic. But this, I've seen seen three people die, and
that's a good number.
Well, that's why I do the show. But the closest I saw was my dad, and I completely know what you're talking about, because his spirit left his body. And I'm not particularly religious, and I don't know. I just mean like who he is left the room, There was just a body, and it really did. It definitely, I think, it helps with this idea that someone's really gone. Like that's what seeing it does, and that's what I guess. Generations ago all had, you know, this that feeling of like maybe they're coming back. Is like, even though I still had that in some ways, but when you've seen a body without breath, it's a very profound experience to go, I see these things just carry us around, and whatever you view as your spirit and your soul or who you are, like all of that stuff, it's not in your body. It isn't. It's just This is just the what they call it, the meat sack.
Exactly.
to transport who your essence is. But yeah, I remember the clearly the moment my dad actually died, just being like, oh my God. Because that body just like, it was just nothing. It was just so strange. Yeah. It was such a strange experience to see that. And as you said, I think it's very lucky if you can be there and you can afford the flight or be in the place at the right time, all of that stuff, it has to come together.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. What happened directly after that moment? Like,
did you
do?
You've done this before, because that's basically exactly. I was like, I hope she asked me that. And you did. I actually, having seen it, I was just right out of there.
Wow, yeah.
I was exactly as you said. I was like, you're not here anymore. Mm. I don't really want to be in a room with, like, just your flesh. It's not interesting to me. Yeah. You've now gone to somewhere else, wherever you've gone. You've drifted off. Become, you know, flown into us or whatever your memory will be, and I'm just gonna off I go. So that's when I went outside into the like hospital car park area, and then I really cried then. Actually, that was like a kind of like, again, that was like a really good, oh, it's weird to say good move. I really, like, obviously I just did what was natural, but I think I was just like, bosh, dead. I probably was out of that room within a minute, 2 minutes, yeah. I feel. Well, time is funny when that happens. But and then I was just out, probably cried for about 20 minutes, half an hour. And I'm not a big crier, but that was just like an obvious like release. And again, that helped. And then I felt like, okay, here we go. Like, this is the new journey has begun. And I've kind of been ready for this for like 10 years.
Yeah.
I remember, oddly, something I remembered from my dad reacting to his mother dying, actually, because his mother, my grandmother, died when she was like 95, 96, something like that. And she had had my dad quite young, maybe like 23, 24. Anyway, so my dad didn't have a fantastic relationship with her. And she lives in Australia. So my dad's Australian, came here in his early 20s. And they didn't have a great relationship. And I think there's a point, you know, where guys get quite, you know, well, actually, any, I don't know. Maybe this is more of maybe I shouldn't gender it, but kind of, you know, when people get older and quite old and they still got a parent around, it's almost like a bit cringe. It's like, oh, I've got a parent. Everyone like could speak of these parents dying and kind of being their own person, you know, by 70. You just think, well, come on. But he still had his mother kind of hanging out.
King Charles syndrome, basically.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Like, she's still there.
Exactly. And actually, I noticed this a bit similar to, actually, that's a really good spot, because I actually noticed something similar with Charles. So yeah, anyway, the day that my grandmother Googs died, I've never seen him happier.
Wow.
He was just bouncing around. He was just like, I'm free, you
wow.
know? Like,
wow.
This is like, and she was in Australia. He was, you know, he missed all the actual death stuff.
Yeah.
I don't think that wouldn't have bothered him at all. And he just kind of, Ollie went, you know, he was a man that saw things dying all the time. If you're a farmer, you know, things die,
yeah,
you know, he's
yeah.
like, he was involved in it. He wasn't oblivious to the world of death. And yeah, and I felt a little bit similar when he died. Elation is a funny word. Like, you know, I suppose, obviously I wasn't happy, but like, you know, so much had been released. Obviously the release of his suffering,
yeah.
The release of this build-up, the ability just to go, look, well, okay, now we've just entered this other world now. And now I can just get on with whatever this other world is. This isn't about like moving on, because you never move on, but this is about just like starting afresh. And there's a lot of in that. There's a lot of kind of satisfaction in knowing that, okay, here's this blank canvas now.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like we can paint something, whatever it's going to be, let's do it. And we all start again in a way. You know, again, but you know, we start
yeah,
a whole
no,
new
totally.
Set of relationships.
And so many people have said that who've had to care for someone for a long time. Like the relief, you know, it is a relief when someone has been very sick. And my dad wasn't ill for a very long time, but I definitely remember feeling, thank God that's done, because it's just watching someone suffer, isn't it? Someone's yeah. in pain in the hospital, all that stuff, and the medicine, and especially at that point when medicine's just like sort of seems to be making someone really sick as well.
Yeah,
like it's they're just dying. And yeah, there is definitely a release and a relief. And like you said, elation isn't quite the right word, but I know what you mean of just like, oh, it's like an out breath, isn't it? It's
yeah.
like, right, well, at least that's over.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's we can close right. the door on that. And now whatever the future is, it doesn't mean that that future is like paved with gold and rainbows. It might be painful, but that is done.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important part of the grief and the death process to acknowledge. And I think sometimes people feel ashamed of that as well, of like, oh, I mustn't think that. I should just be incredibly, it's awful that it's happened. But I think most people, if someone's been ill for a long time, and someone's not young, you know what I mean? I think that's when we can feel those feelings of like it's sudden and someone was too young, taken before their time. We all know that
yeah.
feeling of like, that's not right. But when someone's old and they've been sick for such a long time.
Of course.
Yeah, just the feeling of like, oh God, okay, at least we don't,
yeah.
they don't have to go through that. I don't have to go through, like no one wants to. And I'm sure as a farmer, he could appreciate that thing that we have in this country. You know, you wouldn't do that to an animal. Like he wouldn't let
of
them
course.
Go on
yeah,
for that
yeah,
long
yeah, yeah.
and visit them all the time. Be like, we're still here despite your
yeah.
pain. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Release
no,
really, them from it.
Yeah, he really wanted to die, I think. And I think just generally, I think, maybe this is a bit of a controversial thing to say, but I'll say anyway. I think a attribute of a well-handled life, a life well done, maybe is that, you know, is that after you go, things are well set up without you. I don't just mean in like admin, you know, I don't mean like, you don't have to do this file. I mean, the proof will be in the pudding about so much of your life and what meant to you when you're gone and how others, especially if you've got, you know, a sizable family, or even if you don't actually, you know, whatever size family you have, in the relationships that happen after, in the coming together of that family or however they choose to honour you in whatever, any particular way things happen, I think is a revealer of how you lived. And I think actually one thing my dad managed to do so well is that somehow. And I think it's something you don't necessarily, you know, he wouldn't have sat down with a pen and paper and go, how do I make sure things are harmonious when I'm dead? But yet, when he did die, the family grew stronger. The places that he invested his time in when he was alive were then used by the family more, or you know, it kind of spaces were filled, and there wasn't any of this kind of, you know, you hear so much about, you know, stuff about wills or fallouts or whatever. I've not heard a mention of will regarding my dad. I'm not even sure he had one. But the point is, which again, may be the biggest recipe for a fallout, you would think. But the point is, none of us are his children, so all four of us, none of us care about that. We don't care about possessions. We don't care about any money. Do you know what I mean? That was nothing. None of that was important. And I suppose that was his life as well. That was like what he instilled. So it's kind of, you know, you do set, you know, you by living a certain life, and you do set yourself up well for afterwards. So in a sense, I feel like he's helped make the whatever grieving process, whatever that is, kind of smoother, better by the way he lived.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm really fascinated by that, and I don't think anyone's ever quite put it like that, which is why it's intriguing me so much. Because I do think, it's hard to talk about, isn't it? Because I'm trying to choose my words carefully as well. Yeah. I'm trying to think, because when someone dies, there is a gap in a dynamic, and that could be a family or a work or friends. And what that gap leaves reveals what they did. Do you know what I mean? So like... Completely. You know, when my grandpa died, like a lot of stuff fell apart. And it wasn't until he died that I thought, oh, we had a patriarch. Like, I didn't realize, just my grandpa. And I was like, oh, he was, you know, like this was the one everyone listened to. And like lots of stuff happened after he died, which it just revealed like, oh, I see. Like, and it also revealed to me, I think I can say this, of like perhaps how controlling he had been about certain things.
Yes.
And, you know, and so that's what I think you're talking about, what you're hitting on is, like you said, that he had taught you all, and again, it's not like you don't sit down and plan this, but it's how you live your life, isn't it? It's like, and children learn through how you live, not what
Completely.
You tell them. I have no interest
Completely.
In what you tell them at
That's
all.
It.
They watch. And if you can live your life in an independent way and kindness, obviously it was such a cornerstone of your family for them to bring you in and not adopt you because you were part of the family, but to like envelop you in that and be like, yes, you know, he's one of us. That's it. Then I can see that after his death, there's, like you said, there's not that, like, everyone grab what you can. Like, what? And I think you're right. The death of someone can reveal quite a lot of how they were living, which maybe isn't obvious at first. And I don't think I've talked about this that much. We recently discovered that my dad definitely had ADHD. Which we didn't know about because it wasn't a thing then, but like textbook.
How did you discover
So another family member got diagnosed, and then we were able to kind of go, oh, well, if that's what ADHD is, that's what he had. And and it was a thing. So when he did die, my house became very peaceful because it wasn't peaceful when he was around. And when I say we had a complicated relationship, I think sometimes people find that hard to understand. It's like, we do a podcast about him and you obviously had a lot of grief for him. And I'm like, yeah, because it was so complicated. And because he was such a loud person and so chaotic, that when he died, we were like, oh my God, it's so calm in this house. It's so calm. And what it revealed to me, it said, is like, oh, the way he lived his life was like really, really loud. And a lot of us hadn't said a lot of things because it was so loud that you couldn't. And that's not to say I don't miss him or I'm not sad. It's just the truth of how someone lived their life. So
yeah.
I think what you're saying is really interesting, that your dad had obviously lived in a way that allowed your siblings to go, well, this is what matters. It matters that we carry on, and we know how to carry on. We don't fall to pieces. Obviously, there's nothing wrong if you do fall to pieces. There can be a million reasons why that happens, and it isn't always your parents. But yeah, that's really interesting that he had left you that legacy, I suppose.
Yeah. He was a huge believer in just kind of... So on this farm, it's a small holding, but so many people pass through it. He believed in like the community of it. Mm. And he did this thing. They always welcomed people, you know, various strangers, stragglers, anyone passing through. Lots of people would stay. They had this kind of woofers thing, which is willing workers on organic farms. So people would come. They had homeless people come. They basically was like, they looked after a lot of people, loads of people, big communal meals. The whole place was like rooted in community. And that was what was really important to him. And he kind of built a vision along with his wife, Paul, of what he believed in. Mm. And I suppose also, so all his children are rooted in community and just figuring stuff out together. So again, when he died, we all figured it out together. And we did like stuff that some people wouldn't do. So for instance, like we buried him on the farmland, had a funeral which didn't involve any officials. We just did it ourselves. So again, that, I mean, he would have liked that because it's just, he was an anarchist and he wrote for an anarchist newspaper and he didn't like, you know, state interference and institutions and all this kind of stuff. And since then, I would say my relationships with my siblings have like, it's just never been better. Mm. Again, it's just only grown. And again, that's like part of what he built. It's like we've all just got stronger together. There's been no, you know, like not the slightest hint of fallout or this. I mean, you know, lots of things have been, you know, there's always so much potential for those things. There's never, you know, been nothing. It's only grown stronger. And I've never felt like more part of the family. You know, I've always felt part of the family. But like, you know, there was moments where obviously growing up, I felt like, well, how do I quite fit into this? You know? So that's how this whole kind of grief process so far has been, I would say, kind of, you know, not to, and the beauty of grief, it can whack you in the face anytime.
Yeah.
We know that. But so far, it's been about as smooth as it could be. And I don't think it's been like full of, you know, it's been minimally tragic, you know, like there's been so many positives, really. If anything,
that's amazing. That's really amazing. I feel like we should celebrate that, because so much of the grief stories are like, and then we all fell apart and the silver was taken and my heart isn't, you know, we know that narrative and we're quite familiar with that, and that's almost what we sort of not seek, but like if someone's died and you're like, oh, what happened, or how are the others doing, oh, is it bad, like that's what we expect. So to hear that is so heartwarming, to be like, great, you know, we came together as a community. And he sounds like a very interesting man. Like, you're dropping in these things here, like, oh, a farmer, Australia. Oh, but actually Australian. So he chose to come over here, raise a gun, and writes for an anarchist newspaper. You're like, oh, right, okay. Like, so he was an unusual character, which I think, I used to say it, and I don't say it anymore, because some people don't like it. But I do feel like you live as you die. So, like, it sounds like the way he lived, you know, then was reflected in his death and reflected in the afterwards. And dad was a very loud, chaotic person. And he had a very loud, quick, dramatic, chaotic death. Like,
interesting.
And I know that's not true for everybody, but it sort of resonated with me of like, you know, your death is off. It's a bit, you know, it's connected to
for
you.
Sure.
Like it's not separate from you. It's not something that just happens to you.
I agree.
And obviously that isn't always the case if you're tragically hit by a car, like that is not your connected to you. But yeah, I think it sounds really, like you said, to have a grief process that has been smooth. And I wanted to talk to you, obviously you're an amazing musician and very brilliant, successful musician. I say that because it's hard to do. People feel
that's kind. I mean, I don't know if that's true, but what you just said. But
you make music and you do it regularly. I feel like that is a success. Like, that's what I mean, because it's hard to like have that be a thing in your life, not just a side thing. And I know you have written about him and you had a song about him.
Yeah, that's a whole album, even.
A whole album, yeah.
Yeah, I thought I'd just wipe out, just do an album, then it's kind of done, you know? Get it over and done with.
Has that helped? Do you feel like having the music as an outlet has been helpful? Or do you feel like even without that, it would have been smooth because of this family setup?
Yeah, It would have been absolutely fine without the music, to be honest. But it was something that I'm incredibly lucky to possess. And also, I've always believed music is not about... Part of the reason why I'm slightly successful at music is that I kind of think a lot about other people rather than myself in writing music. A lot of people, and this is totally fine, no shade at all. But a lot of people, you know, their musical experience is very inward. You know, they kind of, they're playing to a corner, or they just kind of, this is important for their own kind of spiritual development, or their kind of whatever they need it for some kind of therapeutic reasons. For me, I've always thought, well, look, if people are going to listen to this, I'm going to need to think about them as well. So I kind of, yeah, the album was kind of, I was thinking actually just for other, you know, what would be meaningful to other people. Obviously, this is something that so many people go through, or we all have to go through, as long as you stay alive long enough. And I thought, well, how can I kind of add to that world? I thought the best way I could do that was actually just being as honest as I could be. Like an actual genuine, just like writing stuff just with nothing, no barrier, just going for it. And I think I've since realised that it has really been, well, I've got a lot of very kind messages about it being a really beneficial piece of work, which is kind of what I hoped it would be. But yeah. I didn't need it myself. That's I did it because I thought it'd be a good project. I wanted to do it. And it gave me excuse to do some other things, like to research my dad a bit more, to ask a few more questions. Where sometimes asking questions after is a bit tricky, you know, like, oh, can I bring this up with X person? If you have got a reason, oh, by the way, Bob, I'm writing an album, so can you tell me about that? Do you know what I mean? So we're talking about...
Yeah, I do. I mean, look, I've got the podcast. I totally know. Because then people go, oh, you said that about your dad. That didn't happen. You're like, did it not? Tell me. What did happen? Because I don't know how to ask you. And it's funny because you can be a very honest person and an honest artist, and you can be someone who's like, yes, let's communicate. And still those things are hard to bring up, you know, like, so that you said to have a reason, a creative reason as well, that's sort of celebrating someone or discussing them in a... you know, from a place of love, not from criticism,
exactly.
Can be really joyful. So yeah, I can totally relate that it gave you an excuse to kind of, I guess, to spend time with who he was and is for a bit.
That's it. And I've also been, I'm a kind of a bit of a, much to my partner's irritation sometimes, I'm a kind of solutions person, you know? Like, I always think there is things you can do, right? And I know, obviously, nothing's going to bring someone back, blah, 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 blah. But there are things you can do to make this grieving process actually better. But sometimes you actually just got to go and do them. Like sitting, I often think it's no good just sitting alone thinking about someone. I mean, it could be good, great, but there are things out there. I guarantee you, to whoever is listening to this, and actually to you too, Carrie, almost certainly, there are things out there, there are people out there now with stories about your dad who are holding them and you don't know what they are.
Oh, yeah.
They exist. Now, obviously, it's a bit of a big thing to suddenly go, well, how am I going to go about getting those? But they're there. So there's work we can do. If anyone wanted to do it, if anyone wanted to bring new meaning, new life, new windows, whatever, to their experience of their dead relative, whoever it is, then it's there. You can go and do it. So I felt like, I then, for this album, I emailed people who I'd never met, who he'd worked with, you know, really out of the blue. You know, some of them may have not even known he had died. I said, look, you know, I'm writing an album, I'm looking to research some stuff. Is there anything you can tell me? And I spoke to some people on the phone. I got emails. I got stories. You know, he was brought, you know, different things would bring him to life. Like, and I think sometimes you've got to go out and do that. It's not just going to happen just by sitting there and hoping it will happen, or will my memory remember something other? Will it kind of twigs and I'll have another thought, or la 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 la, or will I dream of him tonight or her tonight or whatever? So I kind of made a point of going for it, you know, and I'm really glad that I did that. And that was also a big part of wanting to write an album, just to, well, look, let's just try and get some extra details. Let's keep this going for a bit. Let's keep this party going for a bit longer, you know?
What was the best thing you, like, what kind of thing did you get that you were like, oh, that's so good, I'm so glad I asked
that? Yeah, I learned a little bit more about how he kind of did some of his affairs, I think.
Wow, yeah.
Which is like, you know, he was a professor at the London Business School as well. Sorry, I've chucked in some more bits of Bob's here. But he would teach postgraduates about like interpersonal skills in business. So like very serious business school, but he was like the rough guy trying to teach them how to communicate with people. Do you know what I mean? Like the kind of non-businessy skills. But so he would have been around kind of like, I don't know, like younger, you know, attractive people here and there and everywhere in London and kind of a way, you know, so a bit of that, a bit of learning how that happened from his other kind of fellow academics. But you know what the most interesting one was actually, the one that meant the most to me? And again, this is why... this is why you should go and search for these information, because it's like sometimes there's something actually really tiny.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't have to be this huge, oh, he once said this, once said this. It doesn't have to be this huge, profound thing, but it could just be small. So one of them said, and this is obviously an era pre, so it would be 80s, pre, you know, desktop computers, etc., and probably more typewritery effects or whatever. And he said, when he walked into the offices of the, of the London Business School, or the, you know, the room where all the academics were, or, you know, writing or preparing their notes or lessons, whatever they may be doing, he would say everyone in there was always trying to look busy. You know, even if they weren't, they were shuffling papers, writing stuff, you know, tapping around, you know, which I'm sure is kind of, I don't know offices very well because I've never really worked in one, but I'm guessing it's quite a common office thing. You know, you're looking, you know, a superior might walk around.
Yeah, you look like you know what you're doing.
You look like you're doing it in the middle of the park. And he said so often he would go in there and he would just see my dad, and my dad was the only person doing this, and he would just see my dad staring out of the window. Just staring out the window, and just for quite long periods of time, while everyone else was kind of thrashing around. And I don't know, there was just something I felt like such a beautiful insight, even though it was just so small. Just someone who was like not afraid of just not looking like they didn't know what they were doing, just happily thinking, just to look out of a window, thinking, not caring what other people thought of him at all. And just sitting with life and thinking about it, you know, and not rushing it and all this stuff. And, just, again, it's a tiny thing, but I would never have known that if I didn't get in touch with this guy.
No, that's beautiful, Tom. That is beautiful, because I completely understand. It's so small, but as the child of someone, just to get that, a work thing that you never would have seen, you never would have observed them like that.
Yeah.
And so to have that detail is just like, I always say this as well, like, if people... If you know a parent and you know the children, you know, have died, and you have a story, I'm always like, tell them, because I to me they're gold dust. When someone does contact me and be like, oh, by the way, I'm like, oh, like yes, give me the gold dust, especially because my dad obviously died when I was so young. I'm like desperate for information, and it is like, it's such a beautiful detail that he was just staring out the window. Because even now, it's funny, isn't it? Because you say even without phones and computers, we forget you could make yourself look busy with paper, but not be doing anything, just be like shuffling paper and reading the newspaper and not really reading it. To be someone who's not, like you said, to not be part of that, not rat race, but that sort of treadmill, I guess, and just be like, no, I'm here. I can really see him just staring, just thinking.
Yeah.
It does say a lot about a person, doesn't it?
It does. I think one sad thing about when people die is everyone kind of goes to these kind of key stories. Like, they might be funny. And then it almost feels like that's almost left us on. Oh, these five really funny stories. And of course, they might be wonderfully funny, of course. And it's great to tell them. And people think, oh, okay, that's going to cheer people up. Let's tell the story about how you once did this or that. But actually, most of the time, these stories don't say that much about people. Mm. You know, they're a funny thing that happened. They might say a little thing about someone, but actually, the smaller moments probably say way more, but they're kind of harder to tell, and you probably wouldn't sit someone down to kind of tell
them. He looked out windows.
Great. Well, who doesn't?
What a story, guys.
Small content. Fantastic. Like, I'll tell my mates down the pub or something. You know, it's kind of say it's not. But I do think you can, I just think there's things you can do, and I think also there's things you can do before people die, which I think is also a big one. A lot of people contacted me, well, they do still, because of this album. Obviously, I got so many stories of, real life stories, of my parents just died. I don't know what to do. My parents is dying. What should I do? All this stuff, you know, because people just clinging for something or anything. No one is an expert on this, right? It's just everyone does it in their own way. However, I do think there's some beautiful things. So I was so glad. I managed to, one big one for me, I managed to record his voice before he started losing it. Parkinson's, you kind of, you, your voice just gets weaker and weaker and frailer as you go as it progresses. And I managed to do an interview with him where I kind of asked him about his life and blah, blah, blah.
Oh my God.
About 8 or 9 years before he died. So that was like, again, afterwards, absolute gold dust. At the time, I was kind of doing it. I didn't know quite why I wanted to do it, but I did it and I couldn't be, you know, because you can forget someone's voice.
Oh,
people
yeah,
forget that
yeah,
so
totally.
Easily. So I would say, yeah, again, if you can, record people's voices, even if it's just a half an hour chat. I mean, it doesn't, you know, if you want to make it profound, fine, but just to hear their voice is probably enough.
Yeah.
Like, actually, he did say quite a few profound things in this interview I did with him, but that actually doesn't particularly matter. When I listen to it, it's just nice to hear his voice.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't, like, I mean, sure, well, thanks for the profound things, but you've done that from your life. Your life was,
the voice
a profound thing. So it's kind
massive,
of
massive, yeah.
The words don't really matter, but the sound of the voice, someone's voice, is so important to record, and I think people often regret that. Another one is just to keep everything, because, like, you never know what somebody suddenly becomes meaningful later on. So he wrote letters to me up until a certain point. My mum had kept lots of letters. Thank you very much to my mother for that, actually. That was, like, incredibly useful. But, like, after he died, she's like, oh, here's some more letters he wrote. He never had a computer. So I never got an email. I never got a text. Nothing. So there's nothing digital. So I've just got this folder of letters. Yeah, it's just keep everything, basically. Keep everything. Get as much stuff that's going to be useful, not just for you, but then for when you have kids. I want to show, when they're interested a bit more in his life, I'm sure they will be, I want to be able to show them stuff, you know, like, and as much stuff as I can get. Because at some point, I got interested in my grandparents' life.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Yes, and
they've basically got nothing.
It's such also a change now, because you're the same as me, and weirdly, in that I describe us as analog grievers, even though he died in 2019.
I like that.
My dad died in 1998.
Oh, so crikey! Wow, so that really is analog.
Yes, you know, so we don't have digital stuff. You know, you can put a photo on the computer, but everything's from a physical object. And now we're entering this world of digital grieving where people have normally so much.
I actually, a huge benefit actually of the whole analog thing is, as soon as he died, I only wanted one thing actually, which was just one photograph of him.
Yeah.
And I straight away went, Mum, where's that one photograph of him? And I tried to explain it to her, and this is a photograph of him. It's like a really, like, it's basically just his face. It's his, like, really just dominant face photo, you know? And he's like, there's a kind of black backdrop. So all you see really is just the face. And that's a face that I had growing up in my room. So this is like you know, my mother had obviously put, you know, it's like, don't forget your father. Like, here's his picture on your whatever shelf. And, you know, I wouldn't have taken it. I wouldn't have seen any reason not to have it there. But I wasn't particularly fussed to have it there because
this was
someone that was alive. And I never really looked at that photo and thought, oh, whatever. Or, you know, thought much of it. And when he died, it's right where I was like, Mum, where is that photo? That, like, because nothing is more important to me now. Like, I need to find that photo. Because I know exactly the only thing I really want is that photo by my bedside table now. As in, I won that photo. That's it. I don't, all the other photos don't care. I had this focus on this one photo. And eventually, thankfully, she found it. I don't know, maybe like a couple of months after he died.
Yeah.
And that was just like a great moment for me. I was just like, I was so, so happy about it. And that photo now is just bodge dominant. I can just see him when I want to, and, you know, have little chats as you do to kind of photos.
Tom, I could talk to you forever. I really could, but I'm gonna have to say, just for the sake of podcast ears, will start burning. Thank you so much for talking to me about Dennis Pym.
Pleasure.
What a man. He sounds so interesting. So interesting. And I think, God, the way that you've handled your grief and dealt with it is testament to, like, his parenting and him as a person. So that's what an amazing thing to be able to remember him for this hour.
Oh, it's been a delight. Thank you for asking me. I'll do it again.
Round
two. I'll see you on episode 427.
Yeah. You can find more information about Tom at his website, tomrosenthal.co.uk. That's Tom, T-O-M, Rosenthal is R-O-S-E-N-T-H-A-L. You can find out where he's gigging and all his music and what's happening if you head there. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland. It was recorded remotely in his music room, I suppose. His recording studio, that's the word for music room, and my living room. The artwork was provided by Jade Perkins, stop motion animation by Alice Loveday, and the music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, you are not alone.